It couldn't be. The witch grabbed the eyepiece. "Lear, you are a filthy liar," she shouted. Her heart roared like a wind. But it was true. There was nothing but straw and air inside the scarecrow's clothes. No hidden lover returning, no last hope of salvation. And the bees, having none left to attack but the Tin Woodman, flung themselves against him and dropped in black heaps on the ground like charred shadows, their stingers blunted on his fenders. "You've got to give our guests credit for ingenuity," said Lear. "Will you shut up before I tie your tongue in a knot?" said the witch. "I suppose I should start down and get some hors d'oeuvres going. They'll be peckish after these ordeals you're setting them," said Nanny. "Have you an opinion as to cheese and crackers or fresh vegetables with pepper sauce?"
"I say cheese," said Lear.
"Elphaba, what's your opinion?"
But she was too busy doing research in the grimoire.
"It's up to me, as always was the case," said Nanny. "I get to do all the work. I'm supposed to be teary with joy at my age. You'd think I could rest my feet for once, but no. Always the bridesmaid, never the bride."
"Always the godfather, never the god," said Lear.
"Will you two please have mercy on me? Now go on, Nanny, if you're going."
Nanny headed out the door as fast as her old limbs could take her. The witch said,
"Chistery, let her go under her own steam. I need you here."
"Sure, let me tumble to my death. Delighted to be of service," said Nanny. "It's going to be cheese for that."
The witch explained to Chistery what she wanted.
"This is foolish. It'll be dark before long, and they'll tumble over some cliff and die. The poor dears, I'd rather not. I mean the Tin Woodman and the Scarecrow, they can tumble all they want, and not be much hurt, I imagine. A good tinsmith could repair a battered torso. But bring me Dorothy and the Lion. Dorothy has my shoes, and I have a rendezvous with the Lion. We're old friends. Can you do this?"
Chistery squinted, nodded, shook his head, shrugged, spat.
"Well, try. What good are you if you don't try?" she said. "Off with you, and your cronies with you."
She turned to Lear.
"There, are you satisfied? I haven't asked them to be killed. They're being escorted here as our guests. I'll get the shoes and let them go on their way. And then I'll walk this grimoire into the mountains and live in a cave. You're old enough to take care of yourself. Good riddance to bad rubbish. Who needs forgiveness now? Well?"
"They're coming to kill you," he said.
"Yes, and aren't you just breathless with anticipation for that?"
"I'll protect you," he said uneasily, and then added, "but not to the extent of harming Dorothy."
"Oh, go set the table and tell Nanny to forget the cheese and crackers, and go with the vegetables."
She shook her broom at him.
"Go, I tell you, when I tell you to go."
When she was alone, she sank in a heap. Either phenomenal luck lay with these travelers, or they had enough courage, brains, and heart among them to do quite well. She was taking the wrong approach, clearly. She should welcome the child, explain the situation nicely, and get the damned shoes while she could. With the shoes, with the help of the Princess Nastoya, maybe there would be vengeance against the wizard yet. Anyway, the grimoire would be hidden, one way or the other, and the shoes removed outside the wizard's reach. But the shock of the death of her familiars made her blood run cold inside her. She could feel her thoughts and intentions tumbling over and over one another, and she wasn't really sure what she would do when face to face with Dorothy. Lear and Nanny stood on either side of the doorway, smiling, when Chistere and his companions came down with an ill-judged whump, dumping their passengers onto the cobbles of the inner courtyard. The lion moaned in pain and wept from vertigo. Dorothy sat up, clutching the small dog in her arms, and said, "And where might we be now?"
"Welcome," said Nanny, genuflecting.
"Hello," said Lear, twisting one foot around the other and falling over into a bucket of water.
"You must be tired after your long trip," said Nanny. "Would you like to freshen up some before we have a little light meal? Nothing fancy, you know. We're way off the beaten track."
"This is Kiamo Ko," said Lear, beet-red and standing up again. "The stronghold of the Arjiki tribe." "This is still Winky territory?" said the girl anxiously.
"What did she say, the little poppins? Tell her to speak up," said Nanny.
"It's called the Vincus," said Lear. "Winky is a kind of insult."
"Oh, goodness! I wouldn't want to offend anyone," she said. "Mercy, no."
"Aren't you a pretty little girl, all your arms and legs in the right place, and such delicate, sensible, inoffensive skin?" said Nanny, smiling.
"I'm Lear," he said, "and I live here. This is my castle."
"I'm Dorothy," she said, "and I'm very worried about my friends, the Tin Woodman and the Scarecrow. Oh, please, can't somebody do something for them? It's dark, and they'll be lost."
"They can't be hurt. I'll go get them tomorrow in the daylight," said Lear. "Promise, I'd do anything. Really, anything."
"You're so sweet, just like everyone else here," said Dorothy. "Oh, Lion, are you all right? Was it terrible?"
"If the unnamed god had wanted lions to fly, he'd have given them hot air balloons," said the lion. "I'm afraid I lost my lunch somewhere over the ravine."
"Warm welcomes," Nanny chirped. "We've been expecting you. I've worn my fingers to the bone making a little something. It's not much, but everything we have is yours. That's our motto here in the mountains. The traveler is always welcome. Now let's go find some hot water and soap at the pump, shall we, and then go in."
"You're too kind, but I need to find the Wicked Witch of the West," Dorothy said.
"I said the Wicked Witch of the West."
"I'm so sorry to trouble you, and it looks like a perfectly wonderful castle. Perhaps on the way back, if my travels take me this way."
"Oh, well, she lives here, too," said Lear. "With me. Don't worry, she's here."
Dorothy looked a little pale.
"She is?"
The witch appeared at the doorway.
"She is indeed, and here she is," she said, and came down the steps at a clip, her skirts whirling, her broom hurrying to keep up. "Well, Chistere, you did good work. I'm glad to see all my efforts haven't been for naught. You, Dorothy Gale, the one whose house had the nerve to make a crash landing on my sister."
"Well, it wasn't my house, in a legal sense, strictly speaking," said Dorothy. "And in fact, it hardly belonged much to Auntie Em and Uncle Henry, except for maybe a couple of windows in the chimney. I mean, the Mechanics and Farmers First State Bank of Wichita holds the mortgage, so they're the responsible parties. I mean, if you need to be in touch with someone, they're the bank that cares," she explained.
The witch felt suddenly, oddly calm.
"It's nothing to me who owns the house," she said. "The fact is that my sister was alive before you arrived, and now she's dead."
"Oh, and I'm so very sorry about that," said Dorothy nervously. "Really, I am. I'd have done anything to avoid it. I know how terrible I'd feel if a house fell on Auntie Em. Once a board in the porch roof fell on her. She had a big lump on her head and sang hymns all afternoon, but by evening she was her old cranky self." Dorothy tucked her little dog under her arm and went up and took the witch's hands in hers.
"Really, I'm sorry," she insisted. "It's a terrible thing to lose someone. I lost my parents when I was small, and I remember."
"Get off me," said the witch. "I hate false sentiment. It makes my skin crawl."
But the girl held on with a ragged sort of intensity and said nothing, just waited.
"Let go, let go," said the witch.
"Were you close to your sister?" asked Dorothy.
"That's not the point," she snapped.
"Because I was very close to my mama, and when she and Papa were lost at sea, I could hardly bear it."
"Lost at sea? How do you mean?"
said the witch, detaching herself from the clinging child. "They were on their way to visit my grandmama in the old country because she was dying, and a storm came up and their ship went over and broke in half and sank to the bottom of the sea, and they drowned, every soul on board."
"Oh, so they had souls," said the witch,
her mind recoiling at the image of a ship in all that water. "And still do. That's all they have left, I suspect."
"Please, will you not cling so, and come in for something to eat?"
"Come on, you too," said the girl to the lion, and it sulkily rolled onto its big padded paws and followed along.
"So now we turn into a restaurant," thought the witch darkly. "What, shall I send a flying monkey down to Red Windmill to engage a violinist for mood music? What a most peculiar murderer she is turning out to be."
The witch began to think about how she might disarm the girl. It was hard to tell what her weapons were, except for that sort of inane good sense and emotional honesty. During dinner, Dorothy began to cry.
"What, she would have preferred the vegetables to the cheese?" said Nanny.
But the girl would not answer. She set both her hands on the scrubbed oaken tabletop, and her shoulders shook with grief. Lear longed to get up and wrap his arms around her. The witch nodded grimly that he was to stay put. He whacked his milk mug hard on the table in annoyance.
"It's all very nice," Dorothy said at last, sniffling. "But I am so worried for Uncle Henry and Auntie Em. Uncle Henry frets so when I'm just a wee bit late from the schoolhouse, and Auntie Em, well, she can be so cross when she's upset."
"All aunties are cross," said Lear.
"Eat up, for who knows when another meal will come your way," said the witch.
The girl tried to eat, but kept dissolving in tears. Eventually Lear began to tear up too. The little dog Toto begged for scraps, which made the witch think of her own losses. Killyjoy, who had been with her 8 years, a fly-ridden corpse going stiff on the hill among all his progeny. She cared less about the bees and the crows, but Killyjoy was her special pet.
"Well, this is some party," said Nanny. "I wonder if I should have prettied things up with a candle."
"Kindle, candle, candle," said Chistery.
Nanny lit a candle and sang "Happy Birthday to You" to make Dorothy feel better, but no one joined in. Then silence fell. Only Nanny kept eating, finishing the cheese and starting on the candle. Lear was turning white and pink by turns, and Dorothy had begun to stare blankly at a knothole in the polished wood of the trestle table. The witch scratched her fingers with her knife and ran the blade along her forefinger softly, as if it were the feather of a phoenix.
"What's going to happen to me?" said Dorothy, lapsing into a monotone. "I shouldn't have come here."
"Nanny, Lear," said the witch, "take yourselves off to the kitchen. Bring the lion with you.
Is that old bag talking to me? Nanny asked Lear. Why is the little girl crying? Our food not good enough for her?
I'm not leaving Dorothy's side, said the lion.
Don't I know you? Said the witch in a low, even voice. You were the cub they did experiments with in the science lab at Shiz long ago. You were terrified then, and I spoke up for you. I'll save you again if you behave.
I don't want to be saved, said the lion petulantly.
I know the feeling, said the witch. But you can teach me something about animals in the wild, whether they revert or how much. I take it you were raised in the wild. You can be of service. You can protect me when I go out of here with my grimoire, my book of magics, my Malleus Maleficarum, my mesmerizing incunabulum, my Codex of Scarabi, Philfot, and Gamedian, my text thaumaturgical.
The lion roared, so suddenly they were all jolted in their seats, even Dorothy.
"Thunder at night, devil's delight,"
observed Nanny, glancing out the window.
"I better take in the laundry."
"I'm bigger than you," said the lion to the witch, "and I'm not letting Dorothy alone with you."
The witch swooped down and gathered the little dog in her arms. "Chistery, go dump this thing in the fish-well," she said.
Chistery looked dubious, but scampered away with Toto under his arm like a yapping, furry loaf of bread.
"Oh, no! Save him, someone!" said Dorothy.
The witch shot out her hand and pinned her to the table, but the lion had catapulted into the kitchen after the snow monkey and Toto.
"Lear, lock the kitchen door!" shouted the witch. "Bar it so they can't come back."
"No, no," cried Dorothy. "I'll go with you. Just don't hurt Toto. He's done nothing to you."
She turned to Lear and said, "Please don't let that monkey hurt my Toto. The lion is useless. Don't trust him to save my little dog."
"Do I take it? We'll have pudding by the fire," said Nanny, looking up brightly. "It's caramel custard."
The witch took Dorothy's hand and began to lead her away. Lear suddenly leaped over and took hold of Dorothy's other hand.
"You old hag, let her alone," he shouted.
"Lear, really, you pick the most awkward times to develop character," said the witch wearily, quietly. "Don't embarrass yourself and me with this charade of courage."
"I'll be all right. Just take care of Toto," said Dorothy. "Oh, Lear, take care of Toto, no matter what. Please, he needs a home."
Lear leaned over and kissed Dorothy, who fell against the wall in astonishment.
"Release me," mumbled the witch. "Whatever my faults, I don't deserve this."
She pushed Dorothy ahead of her into the tower room and locked the door behind her. The long period of sleeplessness was making her head spin.
"What have you come for?" she said to the girl. "I know why you have tramped all the way from the Emerald City, but go on, tell me to my face. Have you come to murder me, as the rumors say, or do you carry a message from the wizard, maybe? Is he now willing to bargain the book for Nor, the magic for the child? Tell me. Or, I know, he has instructed you to steal my book. Is it that?"
But the girl only backed away, looking left and right for an escape. There was no way out except the window, and that was a deadly fall.
"Tell me," said the witch.
"I am all alone in a strange land. Don't make me do this," said the girl.
"You came to kill me, and then to steal the grimoire."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"First give me the shoes," said the witch, "for they're mine. Then we'll talk."
"I can't. They won't come off," said the girl. "I think that Glinda put a spell on them.
I've been trying to get them off for days. My socks are so sweaty, it's not to be believed.
Give them me, snarled the witch. If you go back to the wizard with them, you'll be playing right into his hands.
No, look, they're stuck, shouted the girl. She kicked at one heel with the other toe. Look, see, I'm trying. They won't come off, honest, promise. I tried to give them to the wizard when he demanded them, but they wouldn't come off. There's something the matter with them. They're too tight or something, or maybe I'm growing.
You have no right to those shoes, said the witch. She circled. The girl backed away, stumbling over furniture, knocking over the beehive, and stepping on the queen bee, who had emerged from the fragments.
Everything I have, every little thing I have, dies when you come across it, said the witch. There's Lear down below, ready to throw me over for the sake of a single kiss. My beasts are dead, my sister is dead. You strewed death in your path, and you're just a girl. You remind me of Noor. She thought the world was magic, and look what happened to her.
What? What happened? Said Dorothy, pitiably playing for time.
She found out just how magic it was. She was kidnapped, and lives her miserable life as a political prisoner.
But so have you kidnapped me, and I asked for none of it, nothing. You must have mercy.
The witch came near and grabbed the girl by the wrist.
Why do you want to murder me? She said. Can you really believe the wizard will do as he says? He doesn't know what truth means, so he does not even know how he lies. And I did not kidnap you, you fool. You came here of your own accord to murder me.
I didn't come to murder anyone, said the girl, shrinking back.
Are you the adept? Said the witch suddenly. Aha! Are you the third adept? Is that it? Nessaros, Glinda, and you? Did Madame Morrible conscript you for service to the hidden power? You work in collusion. My sister's shoes, my friend's charm, and your innocent strength. Admit it. Admit you're the adept. Admit it.
I'm not adept. I'm adopted, said the girl. I'm sure not adept at anything. Can't you tell that?
You're my soul come scavenging for me. I can feel it, said the witch. I won't have it. I won't have it. I won't have a soul. With a soul there is everlastingness, and life has tortured me enough.
The witch pulled Dorothy back to the corridor and stuck the end of her broom in a torch fire. Nanny was hobbling up the stairs, leaning on Chistery, who had some dishes of pudding on a tray.
I locked the whole lot of them in the kitchen until they stopped their roughhousing, Nanny was muttering. Such a hubbub, such a racket, such a wild rumpus. Nanny won't have it. Nanny is too old. They're all beasts.
Below, in the dusty recesses of Kiamo Ko, the dog barked once or twice, the lion roared and pounded against the kitchen door, and Lear shrieked, "Dorothy, we're coming!" But the witch turned and shot out her foot and toppled Nanny over. The old woman rolled and slid, oohing and wooing down the stairs, Chistery chasing after her in consternation. The kitchen door had burst its hinges, and the lion and Lear came tumbling out, falling over the big heap of Nanny at the foot of the stairs.
"Up, you! Up!" shouted the witch. "I'll have done with you before you have done with me!"
Dorothy had wrenched herself free and dashed up the corkscrew stairs of the tower ahead of the witch. There was only one exit, and that was to the parapet. The witch followed in good speed, needing to finish the deed before the lion and Lear arrived. She would get the shoes. She would take the grimoire. She would abandon Lear and Noor and disappear into the wilderness. She would burn the book and the shoes, and then she would bury herself. Dorothy was a dark shape, huddled over, retching on the stones.
"You haven't answered my question," said the witch, poking the torch up high, releasing specters and ghosts among the shadows of the castellations.
You've come hunting me down, and I want to know. Why will you murder me?
The witch slammed the door behind her and locked it. All the better. The girl could only gasp.
You think they're not telling stories about you all over Oz? You think I don't know the wizard sent you here to bring back proof that I was dead?
Oh, that, said Dorothy, that is true, but that's not why I came.
You can't possibly be a competent liar, not with that face.
The witch held the broom up at an angle.
Tell me the truth, and when you've finished, then I'll kill you, for in times like these, my little one, you must kill before you are killed.
I couldn't kill you, said the girl, weeping. I was horror-struck to have killed your sister. How could I kill you, too?
Very charming, said the witch. Very nice, very touching. Then why did you come here?
Yes, the wizard said to murder you, Dorothy said. But I never intended to, and that's not why I came.
The witch held the burning broom even higher, closer, to look in the girl's face.
When they said that it was your sister, and that we had to come here, it was like a prison sentence. I never wanted to, but I thought, well, I would come, and my friends would come with me to help, and I would come, and I would say...
Say what? Cried the witch on the edge.
I would say, said the girl, straightening up, gritting her teeth, I would say to you, would you ever forgive me for that accident, for the death of your sister? Would you ever forgive me, for I could never forgive myself?
The witch shrieked in panic, in disbelief. That even now the world should twist so, offending her once again. Elphaba, who had endured Sarima's refusal to forgive, now begged by a gibbering child for the same mercy always denied her. How could you give such a thing out of your own hollowness? She was caught, twisting, trying, full of will, but toward what? A fragment of the brush of the broom fluttered off and lit on her skirt, and there was a run of flames in her lap, eating up the driest tinder in the vincus.
Oh, will this nightmare never end? Screamed Dorothy.
And she grabbed at a bucket for collecting rainwater that, in the sudden flare-up of light, had come into view. She said, I will save you! And she hurled the water at the witch. An instant of sharp pain before the numbness. The world was floods above and fire below. If there was such a thing as a soul, the soul had gambled on a sort of baptism. And had it won? The body apologizes to the soul for its errors, and the soul asks forgiveness for squatting in the body without invitation. A ring of expectant faces before the light dims. They move in the shadows like ghouls. There is Mama playing with her hair. There is Nessa Rose, stern and bleached as weathered timber. There is Papa, lost in his reflections, looking for himself in the faces of the suspicious heathen. There is Shell, not quite yet himself, despite his apparent wholeness. They become others. They become Nanny in her prime, tart and officious, and Amma Clutch and Amma Vimp and the other Ammas, lumped together now in a maternal blur. They become Bach, sweet and lithe and earnest, as yet unbowed, and Crope and Tibbet in their funny, campy anxiety to be liked, and Averick in his superiority, and Glinda in her gowns, waiting to be good enough to deserve what she gets. And the ones whose stories are over, Manic and Madame Morrible and Dr. Dillamond, and most of all Fiero, whose blue diamonds are the blues of water and of sulphurous fire both. And the ones whose stories are curiously unfinished. Was it to be like this? The Princess Nastoya of the Scroll, whose help could not arrive in time? And Lear, the mysterious foundling boy, pushing out of his peapod? Sarima, who, in her loving welcome and sisterliness, would not forgive, and Sarima's sisters and children and future and past. And the ones who fell to the wizard, including Killyjoy and the other resident creatures, and behind them the wizard himself, a failure until he exiled himself from his own land, and behind him Yackle, whoever she was, if anyone, and the anonymous adepts, if they existed, and the dwarf, who had no name to share. And the creatures of makeshift lives, the hobbled together, the disenfranchised, and the abused, the lion, the scarecrow, the maimed tin woodman. Up from the shadows for an instant, up into the light, then back. The goddess of gifts, the last, reaching in among flames and water, cradling her, crooning something, but the words remain unclear. Oz stretched out from Kiamo Ko a good several hundred miles to the west and north, and even farther to the east and south. On the night the Wicked Witch of the West died, anyone with the eyes to see so well could have looked out from the parapet. Westward, the moon was rising over the thousand-year grasslands. Though the peaceful Unimata refused to join them, the Arjiki clans and the Skrow were meeting to consider a pact of alliance, given the wizard's armies massing up in Cambricia's pass. The Arjiki chieftain and the Princess Nastoya agreed to send a delegation to the Witch of the West and ask for guidance and support. As they toasted her and wished her well, not an hour after her death, the messenger crows Elphaba had dispatched for help were swooped upon by nocturnal rocks and devoured. The moon ran silver up and down the sides of the great Kells, and silver shadows settled in the valleys of the lesser Kells. The scorpions of the Sour Sands came out to sting. The skark of the Thirsk Desert mated in their nests. At the Kvan altar, practitioners of a sect so obscure that it had no name made their nightly oblations for the souls of the dead, assuming, as most do, that the dead had had souls. The Quadling country, a wasteland of mud and frogs, rotted quietly all night, except for an incident in Quoyer. A crocodile entered a nursery and chewed up a small baby. The animal was destroyed, and both corpses were burned with loud wailing and anger. In Gilliken, the banks turned over their money to keep it fresh and vibrant. The factories turned over their wares. The merchants turned over their wives. The students in Shiz turned over intellectual propositions, and the TikTok labor force met secretly in what had used to be the philosophy club to hear the freed and grieving Grammatik talk class revolution. Lady Glinda had a bad night, a night of shakes and regret and pain. She guessed it was the early signs of gout from her rich diet. But she sat up half the night and lit a candle in a window for reasons she couldn't articulate. The moon passed overhead in its path from the Vincus, and she felt its accusatory spotlight and moved back from the tall windows. Across the low ridge of hills known as the Madelines, into the corn basket, looking into the windows of Colwyn Grounds, the moon continued its journey. Frex was asleep, dreaming of Turtleheart, and, yes, of Melina, his beautiful Melina, making him breakfast on the day he went in to preach against the evil clock. Melina was a froth of beauty, huge as a world, spinning him courage, daring, love. Frex hardly stirred when Shell tiptoed in, back from some clandestine rendezvous, and came to sit by the side of his bed. Shell wasn't sure he noticed. He wasn't sure his father really woke up.
"What I never could understand was the teeth," mumbled Frex. "Why the teeth?"
"Who knows why?" said Shell fondly, not understanding the dreamy murmur. "The moon on the Emerald City? It couldn't be seen. Lights too bright, energy too high, spirits too wired. No one looked for it. In a room surprisingly bare and simple for one so powerful and elevated, the sleepless Wizard of Oz wiped his brow and wondered how long his luck would hold out. He had been wondering the same thing for 40 years, and he had hoped that luck would begin to seem habitual, deserved. But he could hear the very mice chewing away at the foundations of his palace. The arrival of that Dorothy Gale from Kansas was a summons, he knew it. He knew it when he saw her face. There was no point in searching after the Grimmery any longer. His avenging angel had come to call him home. A suicide was waiting for him back in his own world, and by now he ought to have learned enough to get through it successfully. He had sent Dorothy, locked in those shoes as she was, to kill the witch. He had sent a girl in to do a man's job. If the witch was the victor, well, that was the troublesome girl out of the way then. Perversely, though, in a fatherly way, he half hoped Dorothy would get through her trials all right. It became a celebrated event, the death of the Wicked Witch of the West. It was hailed as political assassination or a juicy murder. Dorothy's description of what had happened was deemed self-delusion at best, or a bald-faced lie. Murder or mercy-killing or accident, in an indirect way, it helped rid the country of its dictator. Dorothy, more stunned than ever, made her way back to the Emerald City with the Lion, the Tin Woodman, the Scarecrow, and Lear. There Dorothy had her second famous audience with the wizard. Perhaps he again tried to pry the slippers off her for his own purposes, and perhaps Dorothy outwitted him, spurred by the witch's warnings. At any rate, she presented him with something from the witch's house to prove that she had been there. The broom had been burnt beyond recognition, and the Grimmery had seemed too cumbersome to carry, so she brought the green glass bottle that said Miracle ELI on the paper glued to the front. It may merely be apocryphal that when the wizard saw the glass bottle, he gasped and clutched his heart. The story is told in so many ways, depending on who is doing the telling and what needs to be heard at the time. It is a matter of history, however, that shortly thereafter the wizard absconded from the palace. He left in the way he had first arrived, a hot air balloon, just a few hours before seditious ministers were to lead a palace revolt and to hold an execution without trial. A lot of nonsense has been circulated about how Dorothy left Oz. There are some who say that she never did. They say, as they said of Ozma before her, that she is in hiding, in disguise, patient as a maiden, waiting to come back and show herself again. Others insist she flew up into the sky like a saint ascending to the other land, waving her apron giddily and clutching that damn fool dog. Lear disappeared into the sea of humanity in the Emerald City to hunt for his half-sister Noor. He was not heard of again for some time. Whatever may have happened to the original shoes, everyone remembered them as beautiful, even stunning. Well-fashioned, name-brand imitations were always available and never went out of style for very long. The shoes, or their replicas, with their suggestion of residual magic, cropped up at so many public ceremonies that, like the relics of saints, they began to multiply to fill the need. And of the witch? In the life of a witch, there is no after. In the ever-after of a witch, there is no happily. In the story of a witch, there is no afterward. Of that part that is beyond the life story, beyond the story of the life, there is, alas, or perhaps, thank mercy, no telling. She was dead, dead and gone, and all that was left of her was the carapace of her reputation for malice. And there the wicked old witch stayed for a good long time. And did she ever come out? Not yet.
The End. You've been listening to Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West by Gregory Maguire, narrated by John McDonough. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Gregory Maguire's second novel, The Confessions of an Ugly Stepsister, which recounts Cinderella's story from the point of view of one of the much maligned sisters, narrated by Jenny Sterlin, and The Mysteries of Winterthurn, beginning with The Virgin in the Rose Bower by Joyce Carol Oates, also narrated by John McDonough. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the telephone number on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.